Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
And Brian Brushwood.
Man, last night I slept 8 hours in a row, first time in 2 weeks. Who's ready to get weird? This guy.
You know, Brian, I'm sorry to hear that you think you're out of the woods with being sick, because you're about to get a bit of SpaceX fever.
Oh!
Yeah. So listen, folks, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Elon Musk strode across the stage in Adelaide, Australia, which, by the way, he happened to be there because he was building the world's largest battery facility to, like, help supply the Australian electrical grid. But that was just a side project for what he was there to do. What did he do? He blew our minds.
I can't believe it's already this was when it feels like a lifetime ago.
Thursday?
Yeah, it does. It I had the high of excitement, and you and I swapped texts and so on. And now all of a sudden it feels like I'm like, wow, that was just in the last week. That's how fast everything moves.
So a year ago, we talked about his announcement when he first unveiled the plans, said, hey, we want to build a big ass rocket to go to Mars to, like, explore the solar system, et cetera. He said, this is the plan. He says, you know, it's going to cost about $10 billion, et cetera, and all that. You know, our plan is Kickstarter, steal underpants, ...
Yeah.
And people are like, well, that's great, Elon. They're great that you're making a joke about that to pay for it. But yeah, it's going to cost money. We're sorry. Your dream is dead. Dead. You can't figure out how to pay for this, which clearly you can't, let alone the technical things. And you might as well just give it up. Who do you think you are? Elon Musk? You know, Elon went back to the drawing board, literally, and thought it through, thought about the economics of it, realized probably, like, you can have a really great thing, but, you know, unless it's a dumb thing like a high-speed rail that with tremendous opportunities for graft, it's kind of hard to get the government and everybody on board with that, you know? So you kind of got to figure out, like, hey, I'm going to do this. If you like it, hop on board, but I'm not going to wait for you to you know, to say yes or no to give me permission. So what they unveiled was a scaled-down version of the rocket they had last year. They scaled it down. The primary reason they scaled it down was economics, because it's the idea was, instead of building an entirely new factory to build the new rocket, they said, you know what? We could build it in our existing SpaceX facility in Hawthorne, California, which, I don't know, somebody here had been speculating that was something that might likely happen. We'd been talking about the likelihood that that's what we were probably going to see, and that was the announcement that they're going to use their existing facilities to do it. What we didn't say, what I didn't realize, was the whole point of that was, because people said, what about space, you know, there? Well, what they're going to do is they're going to build up a bunch of Falcon 9 rockets, and then they're going to warehouse those. And then, remember, guys, when we walked on the factory floor and we saw them where they were making the Merlin engines and the Octaweb and the fairings and all that?
Yeah.
That's going to be BFR. That's where they're going to be building the BFR rocket. They're going to replace the Falcon 9 rocket with the BFR rocket. It's not this, we're making Falcon 9s and we're making this other thing. Nope. They are iPodding the Falcon 9 with the BFR. They're like, we got an iPhone. What about iPod sales? Yeah, we'll still have a few laying around if you want them, but trust us, you're going to want the new thing.
Yeah, that's a smart play. And so how scaled down is this from the grand vision that we had originally seen? Because it seems to me like it's going to be able to reach the same places just with a smaller cabin.
Yeah, it's going to be, I think the payload to orbit is probably maybe like a third or something like that. It went from 12 meter diameter to 9 meters. So it's now going to be like 30 feet across. But there is a reduced payload, but it'll still be 150 tons to low Earth orbit, right? So it goes to orbit, it uses all its fuel to get there, and then it can dock, and they showed the video of how the thing's going to dock and refuel. So it'll go to just about all the places. It could go to Jupiter orbit, et cetera. You'd have to refuel there. I asked Elon a question on Twitter, which I do not expect an answer to, asking, like, hey, what if you mated two of these together and used one of them as a booster that was fully fueled up and then had it eject? and do what's called a lunar trajectory, where the booster would just get captured by the moon and come back to the Earth. But again, point is, you can still go to Mars, you can go to everywhere, you can go to the moon with this thing. It is still a really, really functional, the most functional rocket we'll ever have, fully reusable. And the business plan was, they said, you know what, if we make a smaller scale rocket, we could go to the International Space Station, fulfill our NASA contracts with that. We could launch satellites from this. We could do other payload missions with this. So maybe that's the smart way moving forward, because we're getting these contracts instead of continuously building new Falcon 9s. What if we shift to this fully reusable rocket, and there's a time frame, maybe 10 or 15 years from now, where that becomes the most cost-effective thing? They showed a graph where they showed how cheap would this rocket be to launch compared to every other rocket that's launched from their Falcon 1s to Saturn 5s. This is the cheapest rocket ever, even cheaper than the Falcon 1 rocket, because when you're going towards full reusability, your primary cost is fuel. And the cost on, to give you an example of like a Falcon 9 rocket, to use what we're using now, it uses the same amount of fuel as like a Aerobus does to go, you know, travel around the world. So it's like $200,000 in fuel.
So I missed the first 20 minutes of this, but I did tune in for the last 40.
Oh, where he talked about Brian Brushwood,
I knew it.
It's just kind of weird, and you know, he's just not as good.
Yeah,
Rogue,
I really think the modern Rogue.
Jason Murphy's the real talent.
I missed the beginning. Was there a moment of, hey, we screwed up, we went back to the drawing board, until you said it just now, I didn't know there was any massively fundamental difference between this and the previous one.
Yeah, I mean, he said that, hey, our initial plan, literally our plan of using Kickstarter underwear pants gnome, you know, the underwear pants gnome from South Park plan of funding it, wasn't going to work. He said literally that wasn't going to, you know, that. And I think what they'd hoped for was last year, hoping for that there would have been a lot more interest from other parties, et cetera. Right now, there's another story that's not been covered, which we'll talk about, like, you know, in a few minutes. But that was the biggest thing, was they said there's a $10 billion price tag. Now, understand, Elon Musk, if he wanted to sell his shares in Tesla, he could afford this. But that would mean giving up this big, huge financial asset to him.
Especially something that I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's fairly bullish on and thinks has even more potential to grow down the way.
Yeah. Now, he said that he wants to, like, I think after like getting the successful Model 3 launch, et cetera, through Tesla, he wants to spend more of his time going into SpaceX and working on that. So that's his goal. But so, yeah, I think that for him, it's this, all right, I can spend half my fortune to make this thing happen, or I can come up with a better business model and make it sustainable over time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, they realized, they changed some things on this rocket. They added now these sort of stabilizer wings. They're not wings in the sense that like the shuttle uses to land, but they're there to increase aerodynamic resistance when it's slowing down in Mars atmosphere, and they're there to add stability for both atmospheric and non-atmospheric. And some other, they put some, a lot of thinking went into this thing.
Yeah.
And how far along is this rocket? To give you an example is, I'm like, oh, that's a great design. The engines that they're going to use to power this thing, they've built those rocket engines. They've been testing those engines on test stands. They've been doing 100-second burns. They would do them longer, but right now that's as much fuel as the test stand supports. They're very comfortable on that. The other big thing was they talk about how the two biggest innovations you're going to need for this, aside from, let's say, the heat shield technology, are the engines and then the tanks that are going to hold your cryogenically cooled, you know, oxygen. And to do that, you need to use a carbon fiber material. Aluminum would be too heavy. You would reduce your payload considerably. And they're simply like, oh, they're going to switch to aluminum. No, they won't. They were going to make carbon fiber work. And they said that, yes, we got carbon fiber to work. We got this tank to work. And actually, it was a larger tank than they're going to need for this production. Now, you're like, all right, it's great they're talking about this. When are they going to start building this? 6 to 9 months.
That's tasty. Like that, I think this is a case where meeting resistance actually will yield better results. I think that it's good that they went to the drawing board. I'm glad that they saw a scaled back version, because they get to use the stuff. They get to start essentially today, and they get to start using it today. And when you're staring in the, it's one thing to stare in the face of a presentation. It's another thing to stare in the face of, like, you know, we're done using VW Beetles to deliver cargo. We now have let's say an RV, right? Or a bus or whatever. And it's like, you know, granted, a bus isn't the best way to move a fleet of people from one coast to another, but you get enough buses and now it's tangible and you can watch it happen.
It is. you know, it absolutely. And it comes down to, like, we've all faced that before. We have ambitious goals, and then we got to say, okay, you're forced to think about your resources. Resource constraints can make you more practical. And once you realize that, you sometimes the solution you come up with is even better, because when you're not using the money hose to solve problems, you're solving it from a different point of view. What's been exciting is that Robert Zubrin, who has been a big advocate for his Mars Express, for kind of a different approach towards going towards space, has been enthusiastic about that. It sounds very much like Zubrin and Elon sat down and Elon kind of explained the economics of what they're trying to do. Zubrin, who was a critic last year, has been enthusiastic about this now.
Dude, that's great.
And we're seeing other people are very
enthusiastic. Because of conversations he's had with Elon, or?
Yeah. Implying that he said he's under NDA with what he's talked with SpaceX about. So yeah. he's very enthusiastic about this. So now, and we'll talk about that, the one more thing in a little bit, but let's talk about the time frame. So he says Elon Musk puts a slide up there and says, when do we expect? Their first goal is they want to send two unmanned spaceships to Mars to do tests at whatever, to measure it, et cetera, to put these things. They want to land two unmanned spaceships on Mars. Which time frame are we talking here? 2022. 5 years from now.
Man, I expect to very likely still be alive by then.
Brian, we hope so. We hope so.
That's remarkable. There are two things that felt the most futuristic when I was a kid. One was going to Mars, and the other was self-driving cars and so on. And here we are at the precipice of having very real discussions about the legislation of it, about working out the legality of it, of whether or not this is something we want to tangibly invest in with our own money the moment we're able to. Future's rad, bro. It's pretty great.
I mean, that's in context, that's before your eldest daughter graduates high school.
Wow.
So let's add to that. So that's 2022 for unmanned, manned on Mars, 2024.
I and I would
manned
imagine
take
so,
off from Mars.
Well, and I would imagine that the second is based entirely on how well the first goes, right?
Yes.
So assuming 2022, because we have a 2 year, every 2 years, there's a especially delightful window for us to send something over. So yes, shoot just literally anything, get it out. And, you know, even if it all it does is just land and do probe stuff, but hopefully what it'll do is start building infrastructure, right? The fact that we have automation that's going to make it possible to start, you know, pulling out the CO2 and making methane out of everything.
So, and everybody's like, you know, I've had people say they're not going to be able to make it. They're not going to make it. It's an ambitious goal. It's actually an ambitious goal. Elon said, yes, it's ambitious. And people talk about, well, you know, Elon has been off before, and I'm going to make an argument here. I'm going to make a point. It is about to make a point. Elon has become more accurate in his estimates.
Oh, as he Elon, ages?
When he started off, before he had started a space company, a rocket company, before he had Tesla growing at the size that it was, he's making estimations based upon the best available information he has. After launching Tesla, trying to do the Model S and getting super ambitious with the Model X and realizing when you have 10,000 part suppliers spread around the world, if one of them is under a delay, the whole thing slows down. With SpaceX realizing, you know what, if I have 5 engineers trying to solve this problem, you know, we may not solve the same sort of problems that we're going to figure out when we have 50 engineers solving the same problem, but working together. He has become more effective. His time frames, for instance, the Model 3, the production model that shipped when he said it would, he says we're doing this production ramp up, and it looks like the production ramp up is increasing, and we're about to see a sharp increase on that. But he hit the production part when he said he would. He's in the middle of Australia putting together this big, huge battery facility there based upon output of the Gigafactory, and the Gigafactory is starting to reach like half capacity, and so he's getting better at estimating these things. The guy that stood on stage in Adelaide, Australia, Thursday night and said, we think we could do it in 2022 and 2024, is not the same guy that made guesses 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
I mean,
does that mean we'll do it? I don't know. The chances are better, though.
That's
And to me, the idea that we're going to quibble on whether or not Elon Musk will hit it in 2022 misses the point on whether or not he is oftentimes late or imperfect on his predictions. He's fairly dead on him pointing to the wall and saying we're going to get over it and then them getting over it. So, like, the predictions that he has made, he has been far more productive about getting things done. And so the idea that we are now at such a short porch timetable on something so fantastic, to me, instead of pointing at whether or not it's going to be, whether or not the unmanned is going to be in 2022 and the manned is going to be in 24, or you bump everything 2 years back, I think that we're going to get something by that time frame. And I think that's super rad.
Well, and when you put in your mind that bumping back 2 years equals just wait one season of Rick and Morty, it's sort of like, it's like, well, that doesn't sound so bad. I've already been through this once, twice.
Yeah, I keep thinking about, like, my example is that, you know, we're looking at a 2024 when we'll be talking about the last season of Westworld.
Yeah, man.
Know, we're in those time frames. You know, we're looking at the second DOI for one of the kids in Stranger Things.
Oh, jeez. I mean, assuming we're still driving by then.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's think about this. So we're now, you know, if we're 2 years off or 4 years off, that's still the most ambitious time frame. If he said, hey, I want to launch people there in, you know, 2028 or 29, whatever the next window is, that's still a decade before NASA has any sort of real, like, NASA has their journey to Mars, but the NASA journey to Mars is not really based on any major technological leaps when it comes to reusability. And that's been the frustrating thing about it.
Well, that's really the key, is that if you can send this guy out to Mars and it can refuel and then just pop right back off and insert itself in an orbit, bringing it back to Earth, there's no reason that they can't do it. And, man, that I don't know. It seems like a really smart play all the way around. I'm really excited about this. How much bigger is this scaled down version of the BFR?
How much smaller is it?
Yeah, sorry. How much bigger is it than what we're doing right now?
It's 150 tons to orbit. It's something like, you know, 5 to 6 times, I think, whatever the Falcon takes to orbit right now to low Earth orbit. Now, the biggest, like the SLS, which is what the NASA's current project is, the SLS rocket, and it's big and its most powerful configuration, they look at saying, well, that'll be able to do like 150 tons to orbit, to low Earth orbit, and ain't reusable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's 150 tons to orbit, and our rocket burns up, and we just blew $2 billion on that. And that's the big difference. Where this, to put 150 tons into orbit using this, you're talking a couple million dollars.
Well, and that's, I think, even the larger thing, going back to what the conversation was in terms of the cost of it the last time Elon Musk got on stage, is that what we're talking about here is not, you know, $10 billion to have a party once, right? It's we're talking about infrastructure to Mars. You know, this is a fundamentally radical concept for space travel, for space exploration. There's obviously more and more people paying attention to the importance of reusable rockets now in terms of understanding how much SpaceX has become a cornerstone. But there was another stat that, Andrew, you and I were talking about just how quickly, I mean, hashtag old enough to remember when SpaceX was the dicey, dodgy, experimental way for you to get to space. But Elon mentioned in this speech about the percentage of all launches they'll be next year.
Yeah, they're going to provide next year. They're going to be providing like half of all launches globally. You add all the launches the Chinese do, the Russians do, now the Indians are doing, everybody, the Europeans and other providers, ULA, et cetera. SpaceX is doing half of all launches on the planet. Okay,
so I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I'm hoping for, because this was the graph that really struck me, the launch rate, 2012, they had 2, and then 2013, they had 3, 6, 7, 8. We are on track for 20 and then 30 next year. That to me seems like a key feature of what it's going to take to put a manned mission to Mars, because on every single one of these launches, we have the exact same capsule that they intend to put people in. That's why they built windows into it and the whole thing. And as a result, I wonder how much faster their rate of learning and verification and of their, it seems to me like they will be able to vastly expand their track record of success of 100% launch rate and everything surviving, which will make people comfortable getting inside the thing once they've seen it done a bazillion times.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to, is the goal is they want to make these things as reliable as airplanes. And here's the funny thing. Rockets, from a technical point of view, a mechanical point of view, are actually simpler than airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems counterintuitive because they're rockets, but they have far fewer moving parts. Now, getting the math right and the fact that, you know, we've had millions and millions of plane flights to evaluate what wears down, what doesn't, that's the big difference, is you're like, oh, well, you know, this little grease that we use to make the rudder function finds out at 30,000 feet it evaporates, whatever. You have these sorts of things that you, this data you can only get from flying things over and over and over and over again. So, you know, that's what we're looking for, absolutely. And the idea of using this one stack to go to the Mars, go to Moon, go to elsewhere and launch stuff into orbit is brilliant. We'll talk about the other application in a second. But it is, if you're looking at, like, we're talking about the SLS launching in 7 years, like the SLS, the bigger version that's supposed to launch, like the same time SpaceX talk about, well, we want to be going to Mars with our rocket. And you have to ask yourself, okay, this rocket that realistically costs $2 billion per launch is over here on the launch pad. Down the road is another rocket that $2 billion would get us, like, I don't know, like 100 or so BFR launches.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
I mean, that's the crucial key here is, you know, I think we need to fundamentally look at things differently for these big projects. I mean, this will obviously be the biggest thing that SpaceX has done in terms of, I think world news that is will capture everybody's attention. But part of it is that we want to do this, so we do it forever. So it just becomes a thing that is done and not a science project.
You know, we had that, whoa, why did we stop going to the moon? It cost $1 billion a seat in 1969 dollars to send people to the moon. If we wanted to keep going to the moon, it would have bankrupted us. We didn't come up with, because it was a program designed to use government contractors for a non-reusable structure. It was amazing what we did, but it was not a sustainable thing. And that's, you know, that's the big difference here. It's just the big, and it's one of these things that's hard for people to appreciate. And I don't know. I mean, I'm just, you know, we'll see what happens. And Blue Origin, we'll see what's going to happen with Blue Origin. Blue Origin's yet to even go orbital, but they have done, you know, reached the Kármán line with their reusable rockets. And Jeff Bezos, you know, one of the richest people in the world, I'm not going to count him out at all, you know,
no.
Which is awesome.
Well, especially when there's the opportunity to learn from what the Vanguard in front of you is doing. You know, it's like, let SpaceX take the hits on the legislative side and the and solve some of the technical problems and so on. There's a lot of advantages to being slightly behind the thought leader.
Oh, yeah. And like Blue Origin, like they hire ex-SpaceX people left and right, you know, for, you know, all the technological capabilities, friction stir welding, all that. But Blue Origin's been doing a smart thing. They're working on the BA-4 engine. They're partnering with ULA. They're going to be building engines for like the Vulcan rocket, which is the Wile E. Coyote semi-reusable rocket that ULA is working on. So they've built a factory in Alabama, which they're playing the game too. Like, hey, where do all the funding, you know, who decides, you know, what funding gets spent on space? Senators from Texas, Alabama, and Florida. So build a factory in Alabama, and you know you're going to be employ a bunch of ex, you know, rocket people there. So, they're playing the game their own way, and I think it's awesome that they're, you know, both of them are doing this. We get people who say like, why not they combine their efforts? Like, imagine if Apple and Android worked together. I don't think anybody'd be happy.
No, it's better we have both. It's better that we have two very, very rad ecosystems. Well, I'll tell you what. You mentioned sustainability, and I think that there is something very, very, very interesting that Elon Musk talked about that we can get to. But first, let's talk about the sustainability of this podcast, and that happens because patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can go to support this very program. Go ahead and kick in a little bit of coin, whatever you think is worth it for this show. You know, if it's a buck, hey, we're always happy to have it. Otherwise, you know, whatever you feel, and that makes sure that we continue to do this show each and every week. It is patreon.com/weirdthings.
Can we talk about the one more thing?
Let's get it. So right now we're looking at the thing that was very smart and pragmatic in the presentations. Elon Musk showed the BFR on Mars, or the Mars city. He showed the progression of a Mars city. And again, people are like, well, what SpaceX planned for this? And notice he made a very point. He pointed out, like, yes, here is the salt. This is the radiation shelter in the BFR. Cause people are like, what about radiation? It's like Elon Musk is on stage going, oh man, we forgot about that.
You know? he's like, I'm against it.
You get these criticisms. I'm gonna rant for a moment against some of the tech coverage of this. So you get, like, he's on stage. He's got like 45 minutes to explain an entire rocket system for going to Mars that's fully reusable. He was thin on these details. It's like he's twirling his mustache. I just hope they don't ask me about this.
Well, and by the way, if you watch the video, you were pointing out to me, Andrew, that you could tell who works for the United Launch Alliance, because they're like magicians at the Magic Castle, sitting there with their arms crossed in the front row.
There were people, yeah, and then there are people just going. You know, it's like, hey, it's the BlackBerry executive. It's the Nokia executives, you know.
Like, he's not like he's going to ask everybody to sign over their life savings right after this. It's a first look at a radical concept.
Well, and also something that they're already doing. He's not asking. He ain't asking for nothing.
If you're an SLS contractor that's hoping for another $10 billion or so funding coming into buying more of these the most expensive machine ever made, and you're hoping to sell these things, and here's a guy going on stage going, you know what? I think I can totally destroy your business model. You're not happy.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, hey, you know, it was bad enough when I lost my job as a typewriter repairman and a buggy whip manufacturer. You know, I thought I had a future in one-time use rockets. So, little rant, side rant. So I did a stream Thursday night, and I said, here's the thing that's going to annoy me, is that there's so many things we need to figure out. There's so many things that need to be answered, and there's a lot of reason for skepticism. 100% on board, and I have my own. What about this? What about this? What about this? But you get this immediate reaction where you get people in a rush to write articles on high-profile tech blogs and stuff who then say things that I would say were idiotic, you know? Like, man, this is not another Silicon Valley guy feeding us a bunch of hype, kind of like that reaction. It's like, yeah, you know, those people that gave us iPhones and Android and the internet, those liars and con artists. But anyhow, my favorite was an article, and I won't say I'm on the verge of saying what it is, but I won't tell you what it was. Okay. Somebody was criticizing it, saying they literally sounded like they woke up some aerospace guy, because he's like, well, I don't have the figures in front of me, but the trajectories for the other thing we'll talk about, I think that would kill people. Which, no. And the other one is, like, the last third of the article is like, another thing that hasn't been considered, and I read a paper on this, was the effect this would have on pilots. How will this affect pilots? The pilots piloting these sort of things.
I don't even want to grace any of that with an answer. I give it only a derisive snort.
There are people out there, again, some of our audience may not fully, okay, like, and I'm like, okay, so is the pilot, what will the pilot do if, let's say, for one of the other mission, is the pilot going to press the button to launch it? Is the pilot going to be looking at their sextant and the stars, figuring out how to steer this? Is the pilot, when it's coming to do a millimeter precision landing that needs, you know, literally billion calculations per second, are they going to be handling the landing on this? It's like when people ask SpaceX, they ask Elon, like, well, are you going to be training your own astronauts? And he's like, to do what? Yeah. Like, we said, we fly mice on the Falcon 9. We didn't have to train them, you know?
I mean, and I think that's one of the things, is that there was a place in the 1960s space race where the technology was at a place. I mean, because that was the original debate between the hotshot pilots and the NASA engineers. They just wanted to build rockets that you didn't do anything, you know, everything was handled, right? But it was the hotshot pilots that are like, no, I ain't gonna be a monkey in space. I want to stick to hold and feel like I'm doing a thing. And and of course that played well with, because the Cold War was essentially a PR war, right? And it's like, yeah, no, our superior human scientists and our human pilots are working together to create human spacecraft and so on. like I'm at a place now. I don't want my daughters to drive cars. I don't want humans touching. Yeah. I don't want us controlling nothing.
Somebody point out, well, radiation affects processors. Yes, that's why, I don't know, in the last 50 or so years of building spacecraft, we've learned to do massive redundancy on these things. These systems are very redundant. And again, you're going 17,000 miles an hour to launch. What person's going to handle this one, you know? And then, I watched was Chris Hadfield, who's an amazing astronaut. He was talking about like, well, I don't think people are ready to get on board something. There's not a pilot there. Are you kidding? If you look at the actual data for commercial airliner disasters, like really look at the data closely, you know what the largest cause of crashing is?
Humans being in the cockpit.
Drunk pilots, pilots that are too tired,
suicidal pilots,
drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm okay with the totally computer controlled. Yes. Mistakes will happen. And, you know, fast forward, Andrew Main, who was the sole passenger, you know, on this ironic episode of Weird Things that this guy you never heard of made. But listen, you know. So we're like, hey, are you happy? We're building. We start next year building the rockets to take us to Mars. Pretty awesome.
Pretty great. That was a great episode of Weird Things. I think we're all done. There really isn't much more to.
What more can we talk about, Brian? I mean, that's kind of it, right?
I mean, you know, we're gonna go to space. We're gonna go to Mars. I mean, it's not like you could do anything else with these rockets, right?
You know, as an aside, last year he made kind of a quip talking about if you had this rocket, you could also use it to go anywhere on the planet really, really quickly.
Yeah, but why would you do that? What would the benefit be? It would cost so much.
Well, there's the thing. So imagine, and again, let's be clear on these things. People are like, oh, they're loud, they're this, they're all this. You know, imagine the first airport, okay? Imagine the first time we did anything. It was the Concorde, whatever. Musk said, hey, if you have a rocket that can get you anywhere in the solar system and land, it can also get you anywhere on Earth in under an hour and most places a half hour. And if it's fully reusable, where your costs are fuel costs, the fuel costs are not more really, and you're using methane, it's not really that more outrageous than really what we're spending to fuel things like commercial airplanes.
Yeah, but look, I've imagined what it's like to be an astronaut. You gotta wear a suit the night before, and it's everything is like pause and go no go, and that's it'll probably take just as long.
You can't eat. For like a night, like you're going to the doctor.
Yeah,
like
that's right. That's right. Like, you have to pee in your spacesuit, and it's like that's not a good way to do it.
Man, look at airline pilots in the 1930s. You know, you got to wear the cool leather jackets, the scarves, the eyeglasses, and all that. You know, so there's that. So the plan is, Musk said, "Hey," and then they showed a video. And again, we don't know what the time frame is for this. And I have a theory on this. We'll get into, but we know the time frame for this. We're watching the video, and people are walking across a dock. And a sign says travel time, 39 minutes to Shanghai. People are on a boat. They're leaving New York City, heading way out to sea because guess what? These rockets are loud. They're now on a floating platform. We assume it's floating platform where there is a BFR rocket and people are walking on board the rocket all nice and casual. They're getting onto a rocket out in the middle of the ocean. What's when it's taking off, right? It's flying. Oh, it's got the two stage, the booster and the upper stage. Okay. And then all of a sudden, once it breaks into the upper atmosphere, what's going to happen is we get our separation. That booster, well, all right. You're like, guys, this is a little far-fetched. I'm watching a rocket separate in two and a booster flying back to Earth.
All right. Well, already so far, I haven't seen anything we ain't done before.
Okay, now what about an upper stage landing? I mean, it can't do that. Oh, wait, we have landed like the shuttle and we have landed rockets. So now the upper stage of the rocket, the spaceship part, is now landing and out in the middle of the ocean or in front of Shanghai. Flight time, 39 minutes. 39 minutes from New York City to Shanghai. Hong Kong to Singapore, 22 minutes. Los Angeles to Toronto, 24 minutes. Bangkok to Dubai, 27 minutes. Tokyo to Singapore, 28 minutes. London to Dubai, 29 minutes. New York to London, 29 minutes. Los Angeles to Hong Kong, 36 minutes. So most long distance trips in less than 30 minutes. So the idea is you build a platform out in the ocean or far enough away from where people will be really, 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 you know, annoyed by the sound, and you take off and you go. Basically into space.
For comparison, the flight for me that I will take later this week from San Francisco to Los Angeles is about 47 minutes. Mm-hmm. The flight that I took last week to Las Vegas was about an hour and 30. So we are looking at, which, I mean, the trip to Vegas in all, in the grand scheme of things, about a hop, skip, and a jump. Normally flights, even if they're closer, tend to not take any shorter than 40 minutes just because it takes time to get up and get down. It's insane. It is effectively saying worldwide travel is about as short as the shortest possible flight.
Yeah, I mean, shorter take you, it'll take you long, it'll take you longer to get to the airport than it will to fly. Okay.
Yeah.
JC Callum points out, well, the earth is flat, so wake up, people. Yeah, well, that'll make it easier, actually. That's what Elon Musk knows. It'll make it easier. It's the shh, don't tell. So is this far-fetched? 100%. You know, are there so many practical applications we have to think about? Absolutely. And I'm gonna flash back when we first talked about the Hyperloop, and I was probably the most bearish out of everybody here.
I doubt that. Don't like anything about the Hyperloop. I still think its prospects are extraordinarily dim.
But people have ignored us, Brian, and there have been lots of funding going into that, and now we're looking at they're planning to do like routes in Dubai and other places for this. Okay. Right. So despite your and my pessimism on this,
yeah,
despite us who are, you know, arguably some of the biggest Elon Musk boosters around, going thinking about all the regulatory and all this. And well, we did say things like, well, maybe in China, maybe like Dubai and other places like that. So what do you think? Like, if you could clear like New York or New Jersey, say, yeah, we're okay if this is offshore, Dubai route.
Well, and this is sort of the,
or that BFR, not Hyperloop, because that would be dumb. But
right. But I think this is that in a weird way, this parallels telecommunications, because in the beginning we had copper wire, and AT&T said we're going to be the only game in town. All of you city folk are going to subsidize our ability to reach the rural folk, and so on. And rural folk, even today, there's in the net neutrality battle. You know, people are saying like, hey, it sucks. I only have one provider and I'm out in the middle of nowhere and you know, copper is the only thing. And we've talked about on this show, well, it's like, well, meanwhile, it's like, you know, you fall for the fallacy of believing that some kind of attached wire is the only way to get internet, because that's what largely is the best solution right now. But in the future, who knows what might be possible. And of course, you know, we get stuff like Project Loon, and we get you know, all these Facebook and Google initiatives to bring everything wirelessly. We're talking about constellations of satellites, bringing broadband, making it totally ubiquitous. And I think in many ways Hyperloop makes sense because it's tangible. I understand you can have a train. I know what a train is, and I know a train going four times as fast would be great, and it would be great if it was safe and in tubes and all that stuff. Well, why not go with that? Because that's something I understand. It's that out-of-the-box thinking. Essentially, it's a wireless solution to deliver bodies all over the entire planet versus a wired solution. And a wired solution requires infrastructure, eminent domain, and you know, permission. You got to buy land. You got to buy infrastructure and all that stuff. Whereas, man, you get these rocket things down, the world opens up. All worlds open up.
Brian, that's a great analogy, and because we get the question, why are we against Hyperloop? We're not against Hyperloop. We love the idea.
Yeah.
The problem is just the reality of the way things. There are reasons why countries like Vietnam and Kenya got cell phones before people got landlines. There are reasons why we're in the 21st century, and you go to other lesser developed countries, and they still don't have roads, because trying to do these bigger projects in the United States, we want to build things like these. We try to take a thing like a high-speed rail, like a perfect high-speed rail could be a great idea, maybe. But we end up saying, okay, well, it's going to be a little expensive here, so what we'll do is we'll use a lot of train corridor track. Okay, well, that train track ain't high-speed rail. That ain't high-speed rail. You're just building a little bit faster train. This ain't high-speed. And you get so many compromises in trying to get the thing done because you have so many people who have to say yes or no to this, and everybody wants a piece of the pie. Everybody wants a piece of the pie. From every politician with a pet project to every company and construction company, et cetera, involved there, they all want to be part of it. Whereas if you go to like, hey, we're going to do wireless, like, let's get permission from the FCC, which is not always easy and challenging itself. But well, I don't have to get permission to put up telephone poles. I don't have to get permission to lay cables. I don't have to do this. So it's this is exactly like why wireless works. So and I think Hyperloop will happen in some places. And I think it'll happen in some places. And then people will go, well, why don't we have it here? But it won't be it's not a matter of the how great the idea is. It's just the way infrastructure works. So here, I think we may see, you know, a route like a I could see very conceivably like, you know, if I think we're going to see and I have an idea how this will get funded, by the way. I think we're going to see an interest like if New York and New Jersey are like if they're like, hey, the governors there are like, hey, listen, they're told like this will be safe. It's going to be far enough away. We're wanting to do this. There's going to be a lot of it's going to be we still can't. You know why we can't land rockets? Yes. At Vandenberg Air Force Base, by the way. Do you, you know this?
I don't.
Because there's like some endangered snail there they're worried about. That's what I was told. Could be wrong, but it's environmental snail, impact though. Studies.
You mean you might snort at it, but that snail, man, that's a charming snail.
Yeah. So and not to make light of concerns about impact and environment, and we all you know understand that there are impacts on there, but some of these things become people who just are very much don't want you to do this thing, and it can become a way to stop you from doing this thing, and some of the ways to resolve these things are problematic. And again, we're not like, screw that. We're very much conscious of these things, but there are people who are in New York who just, and also let's say you're a company that does United Arab Emirates Airlines, or you're somebody who does a lot of those transatlantic routes. You can use environmental stuff to shut down your competition and people don't know that it's you doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan is, so how expensive would this be, though? So Elon says, listen, hop on board rockets. He says, what's the acceleration? So it'll be 3 Gs, the same as a theme park ride. Yes, this will not be as easy as a ride as an airplane. Absolutely 100%. Would I rather spend 30 minutes on a roller coaster getting from here to Shanghai or 20 GD hours on board an airplane?
Yeah, dude. And I know you might say, oh, I'll sleep. As somebody who's made those trips, you can only sleep so much. And then you just get in your head and it's not pleasant. I love the idea of a 3G roller coaster. Thank you very much.
I've done a couple transatlantic flights, a couple transpacific flights. Oh, boy. I'll tell you what. They were when I was a well-seasoned traveler, they were a pain in the butt. And a few of them I was in first class for. Now that I have a more tender back that requires me standing up and stretching fairly often and having the compression hurt your spine a little bit more, oh boy, do I not forward to anything that long again.
I'll take a 30-minute flight in Elon Musk belly punching me. You know, this is the condition. I'm like, it's fine. I'd rather this than 20 hours on an airplane flight.
This idea is something that I do remember being bandied about even before Elon Musk. The idea of rocket transit around the world is something that
I remember the for a long time. The Robert A. Heinlein book Friday. They talked about taking semi ballistics all over the place and how it was kind of an antiquated, old fashioned way to move, but it's so exciting and fun, and you get to experience 3 Gs.
Yeah, so the cost, he says, the cost would be about the same price as a full economy fare traveling to the same place.
Well, and let's say it's double or even triple. If let's say it's a $600 ticket to get to Tokyo from, you know, West Coast somewhere. I mean, if I told you, it's going to be, 15 hours, or you could pay triple, $1,800, and you'll get to fly there and you'll be there the entire experience. You won't go through traditional going to the airport, checking through and all that stuff. You just get on and then land, and it'll be 2 hours from now. You'll be in your hotel room in wherever, Shanghai, let's say. I mean, seems pretty right?
Yeah, I'm looking at LA to Tokyo right here. I'm looking at like a ticket price of, it's 11-hour flight from here. So it's like, $5,000 to $1,000. So yeah, would I pick I'm all on board. And yes, it'll be different and it'll be terrifying. But
it'll
be awesome.
Think about this. They won't need a lavatory. Like, think about the infrastructure they will not need. They won't need to bring food. There'll be no snacks. There'll be no delivery of drinks. There'll be no bathrooms. There'll be no waiting in lines. it will just be, like you said, a roller coaster ride. You know, they don't have those amenities on a roller coaster because you're not going to be there long enough to need any of them.
Yeah. Now I'll give you now let's talk about the funding for this. So there was one of the early SpaceX investors, a guy named Steve Jurvetson, who, if I had to make a guess of who was one of the people booking the trip around the moon, would probably be him too. I think maybe the first time I publicly said that, but he's my guess. But anyhow, Jurvetson started a few months ago. There was a small announcement that he started a separate venture capital fund that is entirely focused on SpaceX efforts. So what does this mean? You're SpaceX. You need a lot of money to do the things that you want to do. Okay. You say, hey, listen, we want to send these rockets to, you know, around the world. We want to build our own international space plane company. All right. SpaceX cannot be spread that thin, and SpaceX is a private company. But SpaceX can go to somebody like Steve Jurvetson and say, hey, listen, if you fundraise and start a company that will eventually be a public company, whatever, we'll make out an arrangement where your SpaceX owns 20 to 30% of the stock. We do an agreement that you're going to be the exclusive use of this for suborbital, rocket flights, whatever. So then you can have this other company that say, we're going to go raise money because we're going to build and I think the reason I brought up Hyperloop earlier is so much capital went into Hyperloop, right? Has already hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars have gone into fund Hyperloop projects. And I think that surprised Elon Musk. I think that surprised him as how much money there was out there willing to fund something like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you start something like a rocket transportation company like this, created as a separate company with an ally of SpaceX, and then go out and fundraising. Like, well, Andrew, how much money could realistically be raised? Uber is worth $60 billion. Uber's had billions of dollars poured into this. Okay. Sounds to me like this is highly fundable. Very, very fundable. And you could also say, listen, our goal is we will contract with SpaceX, but listen, if there's a better option using Blue Origin or whatever, you know, we'll do this, but we think this is very viable. We're in exploratory phase, et cetera. So I think that's what's going to happen.
Well, and that's what's rapidly becoming more realistic, and specifically with more of a standardization from SpaceX, is the availability of the hardware. You know, Uber has exploded because we know there's an abundance of cars, we know that there's an abundance of cell phones, and we know that there are people who want rides cheaper and easier than cabs, and people that will drive them. So it's just a matter of figuring out exactly how that, you know, alchemy kind of comes together to make the most amount of money. For this, it's just the continued understanding that these rockets exist and are safe and can land, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the big question, and are safe. And the only thing that's going to quell the public's situation is nothing but a very, very long track record of perfection. And that's the problem, is that, you know, we pay an inordinate amount of money for the perception of safety to go from 99.999999% to 100, even though largely that's fantasy we're buying into. But that's what we're built of, is an aversion to, you know, there's either zero risk, some risk, or no, or all risk in our
boring
minds. Yeah, or boring, right.
So, and you get the criticism. We saw this here, like, well, what if it only can carry 20 people at a time, the 300 million people on the planet? We're still going to have airplanes. And the argument, I saw this in the other, this tech thing, like, it's another thing for rich D-bags, which it's like, listen, I have my criticism of companies that are trying to do like $250,000 suborbital flights that have no plan to make it cheaper. Like, I don't get excited about that. People are like, what about them? Great. Who's that for? That's for rich D-bags. This is for... this horseless carriage, it's kind of expensive. Great if you're a 10,000-aire, you know.
Well, and that's the thing, is even if let's say all the accusations are 100% correct, and they are, it is just rich D-bags doing it, I'm so fine with that, because they are subsidizing the infrastructure for the rest of us. If they want to spend ridiculous, and essentially that's what happened with the Tesla Roadster. Elon Musk was smart enough to say, let's target the high-end rich D-bags. Let's give them a toy that makes it possible. And it will be stupidly expensive. We won't make a lot of money on it, but we will have an engine to financially support our research that will eventually make it down to everybody.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to, is this is, yes, phase one might be a really high-end, super more expensive than the first-class route. air travel was not for everybody. Now everybody can afford, you know, the amount of time you can work at a minimum wage job to actually afford air travel has changed considerably. It's cheaper now. It's cheaper now to fly. Computers were not for everybody. Cell phones were not for everybody, okay? Now they're encroaching towards the rest of the world, okay? And we can either say, no, boo, I won't be able to, it won't be free for everybody up front, and we don't get anything cool.
So yeah, I'm not for that.
Yeah, yep. Take that back to your coffee shop, hipsters.
All right, well, fine. I'm going to go back and read my Trotsky while you guys enjoy ruining the root future. So, listen,
Kurt Van Killa points out again, you know, that's the idea here. And for the Rockets, I mean, hell, listen, if the rich D-bags also are the ones subsidizing the less safe portion of this when we are at the beginning of the like rockets launching and landing kind of thing. I think it's fine.
Yep. So we have a guest coming up on After Things, Brian Thomas Schmidt, who is the editor of Predator If It Bleeds, which is a book I've actually contributed to. So we're gonna skip Journey Quest this week, and oh man, it's gonna be a doozy. Brian is gonna have to make some ethical choices, and uh-oh, I don't think he's gonna make the right ones because there may be no right choice.
I just want to do. Andrew has ensured that there is no right choice.
Yeah.
Quick shameless plug. Yesterday was the official launch day for The Naturalist, my book, The Naturalist.
Okay, so I already bought the Kindle version. Let's say so now I could double dip and I could buy it again in paperback, right? So I'm just what? I go to the just search for The Naturalist
or Audible.
It's on Audible? That's happening right now. I know what my pick for next week is going to be. Audible. Okay, all right. So I'm going to buy it both in paperback and on Audible.
All the formats.
Paperback. So. And it's today?
Yesterday was the official launch, so it's available now. Available now. And all
that's
right. Formats.
I already pre-ordered it. That's okay, so that's already going to be on its way.
This is the book that spent most of last month at the number one spot. I was just blown away by the reaction to it. It's been phenomenal. It's been a very, very exciting ride, and I might have more stuff to talk about it. We'll see. But yeah, it's available in Audible. It's available in all the formats for all the peoples everywhere around the world.
I got it right now. It's coming tomorrow.
Dude, here we go. I'm going to add to cart right now. I'm going to spend one Audible credit because I went to audible.com/rogue, R-O-G-U-E, to sign up for it.
Sweet. Sweet. I'm going to check my dashboard. Yep. Brian Brushwood's money just got deposited. Fantastic.
Nice.
I love you, the future.
Yeah, I wish it worked that fast. But anyhow, thank you guys, everybody who supported this. I really appreciate it. So anyhow, let's do want to do some picks.
Yes, yes, yes. Yesterday, I appeared on a podcast where we were talking about con movies. And the con movie that I went back and revisited after like 20 years of not watching it is The Sting, 1973, featuring Robert Redford and old blue eyes Paul Newman. It holds up in this timeless, strange other way because on the one hand, the pacing in the movie making is super old fashioned because it's a 45-year-old movie. But on the flip side, that's fine because it's also a time. It's an even older setting for it. Right. Except for the one scene where you definitely see an old fashioned car drive up and in the background is definitely the 1970s skyline of Los Angeles. But having said that, it was it really, really holds up. And it was interesting talking to other people who were and were not familiar with the movie because they didn't know. They're like, well, it seems like this scam was a little far-fetched. And it was fun for me to be the guy who says, oh, no, you don't understand. Everything that's in there is in there because historically it was a very effective scam. And there's all these tales of all these people who were able to do it. There was even one moment that I got totally fooled by a magic trick. You know, John Scarney, the incredible, talented magician who had consulted for many casinos, he did the handwork for Paul Newman during the card scenes. And there's this one moment where you see a green felt table, you see the hands of ostensibly Paul Newman as he shuffles cards, and then he flips over the top card, it's an ace, he deals down a few cards, flips over the top card, it's still an ace, he deals down a few cards, flips over the top cards, it's an ace. And then there's some fancy shuffles and all that stuff. And then the very last movie does is he spreads out the card on the green table, and then he flips him over in a ribbon spread with his hand, and then the camera pans up, and you see Paul Newman. And for a split second, I was like, wait, no, no. And then going back frame by frame, you can see that it's all locked on the hands. He does the ribbon spread, and it's obvious that, you know, one person got up, the other one sat down, and all Paul Newman had to do was flip the cards over and look beautiful with his blue eyes. But man, it really, really holds up. And I'm really bummed that I couldn't talk my kids into watching it because it's an old movie.
Someday. It is a fascinating movie, and next time you're at the castle, I'll introduce you. There's a gentleman, Howard, who's usually sitting at the table near where Di Vernon's bust is, and he's knows a lot of great con stories, knew a lot of interesting con men, and just old school in some of the stories too about curtain running cons too. I met a guy, one of his friends, one of their friends was a guy that would like goes to casinos and wheelchairs and stuff, and it's got all of these amazing sort of grifts and things he does. Just put it this way, if you're a pro football player, thank you. The con man community thanks you.
My pick is going to be Rick and Morty. The last season ended last night, and really, man, I'll tell you what, such a fantastic season. The writing, just great, and you know, the rumor is that they're going to try and do a 14 episode season like they had promised they were going to do for this one next year. But I'm you know, just very pleased that this show gets to exist in the way that it does. So fun.
Yeah, I feel like last season was much stronger than this one overall, and some of the themes on this one just to me were, all right, we're gonna do this again. It's fine. It'll be entertaining. There have been some amazing, outstanding episodes. This one left me a little bit more like, you know, like you guys know where you're really good at, but you don't want to go there. But anyhow,
I'm with you because I think the strength of the season as a whole unit is behind season two, maybe behind season one even. But it's very, very heterogeneous. When it is good, it is the best. Like three of the episodes from the season enter the pantheon of top 10, and I don't see anything knocking them off.
Agreed. Totally agree. There was some fantastic stuff here. So, but it was just other parts you're like, all right, this is, we're making progress. Oh, no, we're not. But anyhow, what an amazing, amazing show. And sometimes we're fearful to criticize things because we don't want them to go away. My pick is this. Blade Runner, the original version, the theatrical version with the narration. If you've never seen Blade Runner before, you need to watch it with the narration first. This is a controversial issue, but if you watch it, people who love Blade Runner almost invariably saw it with the narration first, but they'll tell you, oh, watch the one without the narration. You miss certain things and you don't know as much as what's going on if you see it without the narration, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. See Blade Runner, watch the original version with narration, then watch Ridley Scott's version that is his final form of it. That's my take on that. Blade Runner 2049 comes out Thursday, Friday, and the reviews for that are amazing.
I got to admit, I'm pretty surprised and delighted and thrilled to hear that.
Yeah. Denis Villeneuve, who's the director, he directed Arrival. He directed Sicario. He is probably one of the greatest working directors today. Seems like he's hit a home run with this. And he also says, they asked him, what's his favorite version? He says, well, I saw the theatrical version first with the voiceover, and that's the one I fell in love with. So listen, don't listen to me. Listen to him.
Yeah. Makes sense to me. I guess we're already going in after things. By the way, don't forget, if you are a patron, you get to listen to them back to back, just like the rest of us. Otherwise, make sure to pick up the after things feeds where we talk about what it's like to be an independent creative.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Yeah. Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.